Welcome to the LDN Radio Show, brought to you by the LDN Research Trust. I'm your host, Linda Elsiegood. I have an exciting lineup of guest speakers who are LDN experts in their field. We will be discussing low-dose naltrexone and its many uses in autoimmune diseases, cancers, etc. Thank you for joining us. This show is sponsored by InfoServe America, an independently owned specialty compounding and infusion pharmacy, serving patients in all 50 states since 1994. PCAB accredited and NABP inspected, A-plus rated by the Better Business Bureau. They have 40 staff for excellent customer service. Visit InfoServeAmerica.com. Today my guest is David Kazarian, who's a pharmacist and the CEO of InfoServe America. Thank you for joining me today, David.
Well, thank you for asking me to join you.
You were telling me before we started that your father was a pharmacist. Can you tell us about what it was like for you growing up?
Well, when I was 8 years old, I used to make capsules in the back of the drugstore. And my dad was a pharmacist. He worked for a chain back in those days called Liggett's. And he decided to open up his own pharmacy right across the street from Liggett's. And that's what he did. And I was born 1941 during the war, which kept my dad out of the war because he had a son. And I grew up delivering prescriptions, helping my dad. And he was ahead of his time. He would make penicillin kits. I recall 100,000 units of penicillin would kill anything. And now we've got 2.4 million units, and we've got some things that it won't kill. But as a child, I made capsules in the back of the store. I helped my dad with deliveries. I did everything there was to do in the pharmacy market. Mm-hmm. As time went on, I got interested. I was always restless. My dad passed away, and I learned how much I didn't know when he died, because I thought I knew everything up until then. And my dad got real smart after he died, and he used to say to me, you'll hear the things I'm telling you after I'm gone. And he died in the early 70s, and I still hear things that he's told me. Mm-hmm. I got interested in IV therapy, in the 80s. And we started, hence the name InfuServe America. That was the genesis of the name. We did infusion pharmacy. But as time went on, we got blown sideways into compounding. Well, I shouldn't say that, because back when I got out of school, compounding is what pharmacists did. That's what we did. 50% of what I dispensed, we compounded. So that's what we did. It wasn't a specialty back then. It's what pharmacists, that's what their profession was. As time went on, there was less and less of it. And then as time went on, all of a sudden it started up again, but this time it started as a specialty. And that's why we've been compounding ever since.
Mm-hmm. So when did InfoServe America become a company?
In 1989, I left Connecticut and I moved to Florida. I sold my pharmacies there, came to Florida, and I was immediately bored because I was used to working 16-hour days. So I started a little infusion pharmacy and called InfuServe America, and in 1994 we incorporated. We were doing business as without incorporating, but I suppose you can say InfuServe was born in 1994.
Mm-hmm. So what does the company do now, David? How big is it?
Well, you know, that's a good question. I just looked at my staff. We have 53 people on staff, several pharmacists who are, I suppose we can call them compounding pharmacists, one staff member who taught at a college of pharmacy and also taught courses in compounding for companies that sell chemicals. One pharmacist that has been compounding for multiple years in a place called the compounding shop. And he is our pharmacy manager. So for our company, we were a small company when we started. We had 4 employees, and now we're over 50.
Wow. It's amazing, isn't it?
What's amazing is the payroll. I get frightened every time I look at it.
Well, good stuff, I'm sure. Don't come
but
cheap.
It is. And it is. And I have to tell you, in all honesty, I've been practicing pharmacy for over 50 years, and I've worked with a lot of people. And I have to tell you, this group of individuals is probably the best of the best that I've ever worked with. They're amazing people. They don't know a time clock. They come to work early. They leave late. They do whatever it takes for us to satisfy our customers. And they understand that we're here for the patients that we serve, and they get it. It's not, we don't pay lip service to that. We do it.
Mm-hmm. And when did you first hear about LDN?
Well, that's very interesting, because I will tell you that a doctor by the name of Horowitz called and asked if we could compound it. And I said, of course we can compound it. And when I got off the phone, I turned around to our pharmacist and I said, what's LDN?
Oh, that's funny. And how long ago was that, David?
Fortunately, at the time, some on our staff knew exactly what it was. Mm-hmm. And that was a while ago. And I've learned more about it ever since. It's a very interesting drug. And, of course, your organization has brought a lot of information concerning the properties of LDN, what it can do, and the things it can do. But, you know, I have to tell you, when I was in pharmacy school, we had an old professor, Dr. Lauder. And Dr. Lauder said, and by the way, he was well known. Dr. Lauder formulated K-O-Pectate for the Upjohn Company. At least that's what I was told, and I believe that's true. He held the patent on K-O-Pectate. But at any rate, he was one of my professors, and he said, don't pay attention to what the drug companies tell you about how good a drug is. Pay attention to how much it sells, because if it's a good product, it'll sell. If it's not a good product and it doesn't work as it's supposed to work, people won't buy it. And I will tell you, since we started making LDN, we sell more every month.
Mm-hmm. I believe that.
Well, the product works, and I think it had been a well-kept secret.
Mm. And how do you compound it? Do you do capsules, sublingual,
yes,
liquid, tablets?
We do mostly capsules. Tablets require a tablet press. Mm-hmm. And making tablets is interesting. They can be made, but if somebody's not paying attention, tablets can be pressed too hard and they won't dissolve. Capsules, on the other hand, will always dissolve. Mm-hmm. Their unique formulations can go into capsules and they work. We have made tablets, but we haven't had much call for tablets. And as a matter of fact, I don't even think we have the tablet press anymore.
You'll have to check that out afterwards. So, do you get to meet your patients? Do you know what population are using LDN for which condition? Would you know that
or
not?
Well, when you asked if I get to meet the patients, I have to tell you an interesting story about my dad. When I got out of pharmacy school, I was working the bench, and a physician called, and he ordered a vaccine. So my dad put it up, and he said, "David, quick, take this up to Dr. Stack's office." And I said, "Dad, the driver's right here." He said, no, I want you to take it up. I've spoken to Dr. Stack on the phone for 16 years, and I don't know what he looks like." So I went up, and his receptionist was very kind, let me walk into his office and shake his hand. So that you reminded me of that. And because our pharmacy, we ship all over the United States. We are unique in the fact that we are licensed in all 50 states and the District of Columbia. As a consequence, most of our things are shipped. So do I speak to the patients? Do I know who they are? No. But I will tell you this. The great majority, incidentally, we do speak to our patients, but I don't meet them face to face. Sometimes I do. Sometimes I'll go to a meeting and somebody will come over and they'll say, "Oh, I want to shake your hand. I've known your company for years and I'd like to meet you." But most of the time we speak to them over the phone, and I'll tell you a great majority of our patients use LDN for Lyme disease.
I wondered when you said Dr. Richard Horowitz, he took part in our Lyme disease documentary. So I did wonder if Lyme was a big part of your pharmacy.
When we started, that was our only business. That was our total focus. It was 100% of our patients. Now it's probably 20 to 25% of what we do. Mm-hmm. But we still do have a large Lyme population. And it's sad because these folks get abused by the system. I've seen many cases where these patients had Lyme disease for years and was never diagnosed. And they were told that they had imaginary pain. As a matter of fact, early on in my career of treating patients with Lyme, I met a psychiatrist that was ordering antibiotics. And I looked at him. I went to his office, and on the wall were these degrees in psychiatry. And I'm thinking, why is a psychiatrist ordering antibiotics? And he told me that he got many referrals for patients that physicians thought they were nuts. So he examined them, and he thought, you know, there's something organic going on. And he treated them with antibiotics, and they got well. They improved. Mm-hmm. And his practice moved from psychiatry to Lyme disease. Wow. Which was very interesting. People were diagnosed as having a mental disorder when, in fact, they had an organic. They were infected with bacteria.
Well, I'm sure there are some people who do have mental issues, who do present with maybe Lyme-type symptoms. But the number of people that contact me who find it difficult to get off the sofa, they have difficulty in thinking, they have lots of pain, etc., etc. And then to be told, on top of feeling like that, that it's imaginary, you know, you're just depressed, must be absolutely soul-destroying when nobody believes you.
You have no idea. The patients that talk to us, I've heard the story so many times, I could regurgitate it by memory. Mm-hmm. People go for years. They're told their pains are imaginary. They then their insurance companies refused to pay, and that's another thing we did. We started this pharmacy because I was involved with another company where I had a partner that her, oh, I should be kind. She enjoyed making money. I worry about the patient more than making money. And some of her practices I didn't agree with, and I said, you and I can't be partners anymore. And I moved to Florida and started this company. And I tried to sell products that that were used for Lyme disease as cheap as I could. So that, because these people, it broke my heart. They're sticking their hand into their pocket and they're paying. They pay for insurance, and insurance says, no, we've treated you for 30 days. You don't need any more treatment. So they've got to put their hand in their pocket and pay for these drugs themselves. So we tried to keep our prices as low as possible, and that was the genesis of InfuServe America. That's why the company really started. I felt badly that I was a part of a company that may have charged patients who were hurting a lot of money, and I wanted to repent for my sins, and that's why I started this company.
Mm-hmm.
And we meet, the staff meets once a month, the first Wednesday of the month, and at least quarterly, I remind people why we're here. I tell them we're not here to make a profit, although I'd like to make a profit.
Mm-hmm.
We're here for one reason, and that's to treat the patients we serve. A lady called because she had a vitamin mixture, and I got a call from my case management office. They told me she dropped a bag of IV solution and broke it. It was her fault. It slipped and broke, and she needed to order it. It was $165 for that bag of that vitamin mixture that she destroyed. And she had asked if we could ship it to her without charging her for shipping because FedEx refrigerated box is expensive. I told the person that called, tell her we'll just give it to her, no charge.
Oh.
Because my heart breaks for these folks. I don't care. And we've got some wealthy people that are customers of ours. But how many months of paying $3,500, $4,200, how many months can you sustain that? I don't care how much you've got. That hurts.
Mm.
And there are some people who are on Medicaid, and they can't get the drugs on Medicaid, so their families are helping them so that they can get the drug. That breaks my heart when these folks have to pay a lot of money for medication. So we've tried to keep our prices low. But the other thing that's happened, the regulatory in the environment that we live, things have changed a great deal since I started the company. Many things have happened where regulations have actually increased prices of drugs. I'm often amused when people come out, senators and our president and Congress people come out and say, we've got to find a way to get prices lower. And when I hear that, I scream at the television or radio, look in a mirror, you're the reason prices are so high.
Mm.
Because the regulations that have been passed that have created so many problems for us, I'll give you one example. We are licensed in 50 states and the District of Columbia. So we get a very rigorous inspection by the Florida Board of Pharmacy. In the old days, that's all that was required. The Board of Pharmacy would come in, they'd inspect us, we'd send a copy of the inspection report to the state that's the other state, and they would accept that. Well, now they won't accept that. So now we're inspected by the Florida Board of Pharmacy, the California Board of Pharmacy, the Texas Board of Pharmacy, the Pharmacy Compounding Board, Accreditation Board. And we have to send all of these inspections out when we go to get licensed from that particular state. Now, those things cost. California, for instance, we have to pay for the airline ticket for that person to come here. We have to pay for their time when they're here. And then they grab some compounded products that we've made and they send it out for testing. All of that costs money. And it happens over and over and over. And somebody said it won't be long before there'll be an inspector in here every month.
Wow. So...
And this, of course, pushes. Forgive me. All of these inspections and all of these things that they make you do. You can't use non-sterile gloves. Now you have to use sterile gloves. You can't use a smock. You must use a sterile smock. You can't recycle the sterile smock. In other words, put it on, go into the clean room, come out to lunch, hang up that bunny suit that you're wearing. Come back in and put the same bunny suit on. No, it's got to be new. So in bunny suits alone, we're spending over $1,000 a month that we never spent. Well, this trickles down to the patient, that poor person that's sticking their hand in their pocket and pulling out money to pay for their drugs.
So do you have to be inspected by all 50 states every year, or is the license longer than 12 months?
It depends. It depends on the state. Some are annual, some are semi-annual. It really depends on the state.
But you would think, wouldn't you, if there was some inspection that all the states had agreed on, that these are the boxes that have to be ticked for California, these are the boxes that need to be ticked for Texas, for example, and that must be more or less the same. But even if some states wanted to add on some extra things and they had an independent inspector to make sure that you were completely compliant for all 50 states, that one piece of paper would suffice, wouldn't you?
Well, it appears to be moving in that direction. The Pharmacy Compounding Accreditation Board has, it's not the Pharmacy Compounding Accreditation Board. It slipped my mind. There is a group that represents, an association that represents all the boards of pharmacy.
Okay.
And that organization inspected us for the state of Texas. And that, if you use that inspection, that was more money. But they did exactly what you said. They had little check boxes for each of the states that would accept their inspection. Mm-hmm. It wasn't all 50 states. I think it was, 12 or 13 maybe, that would accept that inspection. But hopefully we're moving in that direction. Of course, there will be some states that I can't imagine will ever accept it. Mm-hmm. California comes to mind because their regulations are so different. We have to keep two inventories because of California. One for 49 states, one for California, because their rules are so different.
Well, I mean, because it would make sense, even if you had to pay double for the inspection that you would pay just for one state, but if they were doing a thorough one, even if you had to pay double, but then it was able to be used everywhere, it would still be cheaper, it would be less disruptive for you, because it must be terrible having all these inspections. You can't continue your normal pattern for your pharmacy when you've got strangers in the building.
You're exactly correct. Everything stops. Mm-hmm. And well, everything doesn't stop. That's not true. But you pull out your key people to be with the inspectors, and they ask questions, and they're there. Some of the inspections last 2 days, some are 1 day. Some of them tell you they're coming. The Pharmacy Compounding Accreditation Board is a longer inspection, but you have to prepare for it, going through what their criteria is. And it's not so much that you're scrambling to do new things or change the way you do things, but what you're scrambling to do is, well, they ask this question, where in your policy manual does it say you do that? So you want to find it for the inspector. So when the inspector comes in, you tell him, oh, okay, that's policy 105.2. That's where it explains what we do. So the preparation for these things takes a lot of time. And you want to do that before the inspector's here, because if you don't find it and it's there, he'll write down that you're not doing that, that it's not in your policy. And we've had that happen. Sadly, several years ago, the Board of Pharmacy in Florida changed their inspection, and they came in and, oh, they found 23 things that were wrong. Of the 23 things, there were two that were actually wrong, both of which we had addressed. But because we couldn't find it, they waited until the 11th hour to ask us, and were scrambling trying to find the policy that addressed the issue. They said we didn't have it, and they walked off. And that was problematic, because now when you send that pharmacy to other state, that inspection report to other states, that puts you in jeopardy. So we had a book that went out to every state explaining, no, the inspector didn't see this policy, and we showed them, we illustrated the policy and the date of the policy, which was long before the inspection was here. So there's a lot of things that go on for the inspections, and I'm not saying the inspections are bad. We signed up voluntarily for the Pharmacy Compounding Accreditation Board, which is a very rigorous inspection. We did that. I wanted to do that to make sure that we did do things as we should be doing and above what we should be doing. One little example, in all of my clean rooms, I have UV lights. UV lights kill bacteria, mold, and fungus. Those UV lights go on at 11 o'clock for 20 minutes, and they go on at 7 a.m. for 20 minutes, 11 p.m. and 7 a.m. I do that to make sure that if any bacteria do get through the system, they get killed. This is not a requirement, but we do it. We had our clean rooms inspected twice a year, semi-annually, when the rules were do it annually. We do fingertip testing, and we do a lot of things on a weekly basis that the regulations say you should do every 6 months. So we've always tried to be ahead of the curve. And I don't disagree with inspections, but my God, if you've if you've done an inspection and you've come out clean, what's the purpose of doing it again and again?
So is your facility huge? Is it a really large facility, considering you can ship throughout the U.S.?
Well, we've got a 32,000 square foot building, and we occupy all but 2,000 square feet of that.
Wow.
We have one tenant in the building, and I can't wait for him to move out. Oh, I should say that quietly.
Wow, that is really big. So you are a sterile and a non-sterile pharmacy?
We compound. Actually, there are three things that we do. We compound sterile. We compound non-sterile. We do clinical trials. And we also have a lab, a testing lab, to test the products that we make. not only for us, but for other pharmacies in the United States. They'll send us the products that they have mixed, and we'll tell them if it's sterile and whether it has endotoxin.
Mm-hmm. I can remember meeting a gentleman at one of the conferences back in 2009, I think, and he said that he could bring in some LDN into the UK at a fraction of the price from India. So he sent a sample, which I sent off, and it came back. It wasn't compliant in any which way, shape or form. It just was not acceptable. So I told him, thank you very much, but no. And he said, well, can I get them to up their standard and do it again? So I was a bit, well, anyway, he insisted, and he sent this second sample. And as you know, testing samples isn't cheap. And it was slightly better, but it still didn't reach any standards. So he had the cheek to say, can I do it for a third time? And it was like, no, because if the quality had been good enough, even on the first batch, feeling I get was that that batch might be okay, but then from then on, every batch would need to be tested to make sure that they hadn't slipped.
Well, that's something that there are a couple components of testing. First is you test the product that you're buying. It wasn't LDN, it was another product, glutathione, that we make. There was a shortage, and we used a company that we had never used. We tested it, and what we found was a high level of endotoxin in the product. So we wouldn't use it. We just told our patients we couldn't get it. We didn't want to use this product. So, and it's interesting because that was a couple of years ago, and the FDA just came down and said compounding pharmacists should not use this company's product. Mm-hmm. We never did. So the components are you've got to test the raw material to make sure the raw material is good. Then once you've done it, once you've made it, you've got to test the end product to see if the end product is what you say it is. It's the right weight. It's the right strength. With sterile products, you have to test the sterility of every batch you make, and the potency, the product potency, you test once. And as long as you make it with the same product, the same way, you test that potency only annually. Mm-hmm. Now, with LDN, it's a non-sterile product, so you check the powder for bioburden to make sure it's not contaminated. And then you check the product, we check the product once to make sure that it's what it says it is, and then you can compound it and make it. Mm-hmm. The bioburden testing is done when you buy large batches. Every time you get the large batch of raw chemical, the potency testing we do on an annual basis.
And of course, for the people that are listening who might be considering of buying LDN off the internet, and I'm always saying that if you buy something that has bypassed any testing, it can be anything. The MHRA, which is the medicines regulatory body here in the UK, say that of drugs that have been imported into the UK that they have seized, say that 85% are counterfeit, and some of them are just placebo, but some of them are harmful. So, I mean, you are inspected, you test all your products. So when people buy, have their prescriptions filled with you, that they know that they are getting a very good quality product.
Well, you have to do testing, because that story I told you about the product that had endotoxin, came from a reasonably reputable firm. The company is well known in the compounding circles. They have a lot of products they sell. Some of their products we use. So yeah, that's why you've got to be very careful. We are getting pushed by the FDA more and more to be like a manufacturer. And a lot of the things that we're doing is what a manufacturer would have to do. When we started compounding a lot of things, I went to a manufacturer's. There's a friend of mine has a pharmacy manufacturing firm right down the street. And I asked him about FDA visits and a lot of things. And we watched what they did. And they said when they get raw powder in, they have to test the square root of the powder plus one, the square root of what they got. So if they got 4 barrels of morphine powder, they'd have to test the square root, which is 2 plus 1. So they'd test 3 of them. 1 barrel wouldn't be tested. Mm-hmm. Because if it all was the same lot number, you're testing enough to be able to determine that everything that we have is safe. Now, we don't get so many things that we have to do that. But we do test our powders when they come in for bioburden to make sure that they're okay. And we only buy it from firms that we have faith that we trust, that we have faith in the company.
I'm going to have to say, David, we've actually overrun. I'm going to have to end it there. But we will another day interview some of your pharmacists and find out from their point of view what they do.
I would welcome that.
Well, thank you very much for being an amazing guest and enlightening us on the world of compounding.
Thank you very much, and I look forward to seeing you at one of your meetings.
Well, perhaps we can get you to come to Portland, 7th to the 9th of June, the LDN 2019 conference.
Actually, I won't be there, but one of my pharmacists will. I'll be in China.
Ah, okay. Well, again, thank you very much for being with us.
All right. You're very welcome. Take care.
This show is sponsored by InfoServe America, an independently owned specialty compounding and infusion pharmacy, serving patients in all 50 states since 1994. PCAB accredited and NABP inspected, A+ rated by the Better Business Bureau. They have 40 staff for excellent customer service. Visit infoserveamerica.com. Any questions or comments you may have, please email me, Linda, LINDA, at ldnrt.org. I look forward to hearing from you. Thank you for joining us today. We really appreciated your company. Until next time, stay safe and keep well.